Welcome to episode 16 of While I Breathe, the official podcast of the ACLU of South Carolina. I'm your host, Jace Woodrum.
And I'm your other host, Paul Bowers.
So this episode is the second in a two-part series about immigration and the Trump administration's mass deportation agenda in South Carolina. So if you haven't listened to episode 15, you might want to go back and do that before you start this one. But since that last episode, a lot has happened around immigration. Man, it's hard to even keep track. Paul, what has happened since our last episode?
Yeah, it's gotten uglier. Anybody who's been watching the news knows that ICE has really stepped up enforcement in cities like Chicago. And there's been a lot of peaceful protests, a lot of people pushing back. But as these immigration agents take more and more public action and carry out more raids, we're seeing more and more footage of how they actually operate. And the pattern we're seeing is they wear masks, they don't identify themselves, they often don't have a warrant to show, and they take violent action. And, we've seen ICE agents arresting U.S. citizens, attacking nonviolent protesters. There's a photo that I think will be in history books of ICE agents pepper spraying protesters in the face. And it's the kind of thing that immigrant rights workers and people who serve immigrant communities have been warning about for years. But now it is just out in the light of day. And a lot of people in the general public are really stunned by how it's been going.
Yeah, it's really heartbreaking and scary and infuriating. And what I worry about is that we're going to see what's been playing out in Chicago, that we're going to see it here in South Carolina. And the reason I'm worried about that is because 287G agreements have expanded now tenfold. And as a reminder, 287G agreements are the agreements that local law enforcement signs that signs them up for doing immigration enforcement in their community. And they have just rapidly increased this year, and including the Department of Public Safety. That's our highway patrol. So now, statewide on our highways, we're going to see South Carolina law enforcement acting as immigration agents. And I'm really terrified that we're going to see the same kind of masked enforcement officers harming people who try to stand up and protest and harming immigrants and their families under this, regime, Trump's regime and his mass deportation agenda.
Another worrying development was at the start of this month in October. Our governor, Henry McMaster, and one of our senators, Lindsey Graham, held a press conference where they put a little more pressure on law enforcement agencies to sign these 287G agreements. And, they're publicly calling on them to join in this work, and they're incentivizing it with some federal money. It's still not really clear if that money actually makes up for the local cost of doing this. And it's abundantly clear that joining in that work harms local police and sheriff's deputies in terms of their reputation with locals. It's really harming the whatever trusts they have built up to this point. Yeah, it's been a really difficult month, but at the same time, we've seen people getting organized, finding ways to educate each other. Our colleague Dulce, who we'll talk to on this episode in a minute, has been hosting Know Your Rights trainings. People are finding ways to meaningfully resist.
Yeah, our previous episode focused on the upstate. That's where I grew up, actually. And we highlighted how the mass deportation agenda was affecting small towns in Oconee County. Now, for this episode, we are turning our attention to the Low Country, where you're from, Paul. So where are you taking us today?
Right. So first, we're going to talk about Ladson, which is a community near Charleston. It's in parts of Charleston, Berkeley, and Dorchester counties. It was the site of a massive immigration raid earlier this year that's maybe the most well-known immigration raid in our state so far. And from there, we'll go to Beaufort County, where a lot of locals have been showing up and pressuring the sheriff not to partner with ICE. So Dulce and I and some allies made a trip to Beaufort County and recorded how that meeting went, where people actually spoke face-to-face with the sheriff to share their concerns. And we're going to follow how that went, how the sheriff received it, and what that local law enforcement agency ended up doing.
Okay, well, it sounds like there's a lot to get to, a lot that's been happening in the Lowcountry. So we will start with part two of your interview with Dulce, who, as you reminded us, is our immigrant rights advocacy strategist. She's the first person to hold this new position at our organization. So grateful for her work and leadership. Let's get started and listen to what she has to say.
This was late at night, around 2 or 3 a.m., June 1st, at the Alamo nightclub in Ladson. So the authorities arrested at least 80 people that we know of, the majority of them on immigration charges. And they claimed at the time that two of the arrestees were high-level cartel members associated with Los Zetas and Tren de Aragua. And to this day, they've not released the names of most of the people they arrested, incident reports from the arrests, or given any real proof of their claims about what was going on that night. So, you know, at the time, this was a pretty chaotic scene. I remember, you know, getting a text message from a friend at 3 a.m. about it, and people were trying to piece together what was happening, why all these different agencies were suddenly storming this bar in the middle of the night, what this was all about. So the initial reaction was a lot of fear. A lot of people were worried and confused about what was really happening. Tell me about this. I mean, you know, you've worked in immigrant rights spaces for a while now. This was a huge raid, and it involved state, local, and federal agencies in the middle of the night descending on this place. Was there any real precedent for that in the Charleston area? Is this something they would normally do, or are we in really new territory at this point?
So when this happened, I was also getting a lot of text messages from friends and people in the community saying, like, oh my God, this is happening. ICE is in our communities. They're here. And when I woke up, it was like a sense of fear taking over me, because this had been unprecedented. Like, we had seen ICE knocking on doors and, like, officers pulling over people and then placing a hold on them for immigration. But we had not seen this large-scale operation in our community. In this case, it was El Alamo. And I think the most concerning thing about this was the way the media and public officials painted this operation. They painted our community as criminals, as cartel members. I remember one of the headlines was like, oh, the cartel after party. And then the White House even posted on their social media that they had essentially arrested like all of these cartel members, making it seem like our community is filled with criminals and cartel members and drug dealers and whatever you want to call it, the worst of the worst, when that was not the case at all.
You spoke to a lot of people after the fact, you know, including eyewitnesses who were there that night who were not arrested. And one person you spoke to said that officers were separating people who had tattoos and questioning them about their tattoos and gang affiliation. Tell me a little bit about that. I mean, is that cause for concern based on what we know about how ICE operates in this country?
So first of all, they separated Hispanic people from non-Hispanic looking people. So those that did not look Hispanic enough, they were allowed to exit the building first. And then those who stayed behind, they were asked if they had tattoos, if they did have visible tattoos, they were separated into a separate line. And then ask about their gang affiliation, assuming that every and any person who has a tattoo is a gang affiliated. And I think this speaks volumes to how this administration sees our communities. They see a Hispanic person and immediately assume that they may be here undocumented. And I think that's a big concern to begin with. Regardless of if you're a U.S. citizen, a permanent resident, or are here on a valid visa, if you look Hispanic or you don't look like you belong to this country, then you're going to be questioned about your status. So let's clear that first. And then second, the fact that when law enforcement went on to talk about the outstanding warrants, they said, oh, there is 116 outstanding warrants issued for criminals, essentially. And then they got to this location and they did this operation, but they had no understanding of who was there, why were they there, if they were even connected to crime. They assumed based on their tattoos that they were gang affiliated. But then they went on the news and said this was a cartel after party. I think that's very concerning when they paint the community as criminals and they make it seem like they knew who was there and what criminal activity they were doing. But a lot of those people were there to have a fun night out after a long, hard week of work. But because they had a tattoo, now they're gang affiliated.
Yeah, I think anybody who's been paying attention to the way ICE operates, especially this year, is familiar with just the pattern of racial profiling, as you mentioned. I mean, that's pretty blatant. They'll question people because of their last name or their appearance or just a guess about where somebody is from. And then, yeah, the tattoo thing. You know, we've heard stories from all over the country of people being questioned, arrested, even sent to detention camps based on having a tattoo of a crown or a tattoo for, you know, their favorite soccer team, a tattoo honoring their mom. Just, it's so haphazard, and it's putting people's lives in jeopardy over unwarranted suspicions. There was, as you said, you know, the White House made a big to-do about this. The official White House Instagram account posted video from the raid of these officers going in and arresting people. They said, cartel party next door, let us know, we'll bring ICE. And that sort of cartel line just kind of got trotted out, as you say, just repeated again and again in the media without a lot of proof to back it up. It was just a quote that people ran with.
Yeah, and to this day, we don't even know who were these cartel members supposedly. Where are the names?
Right. I used to be a news reporter, and I know that at these, you know, at arrests, you know, law enforcement will often make a lot of claims right off the bat, but those don't always end up being substantiated. They'll say things, and then sometimes those claims don't actually pan out. So it's worth applying a lot of suspicion to early claims and asking for proof. And there was this press conference right after this raid. There's an officer from the Department of Homeland Security who said, this operation was not only about immigration enforcement, it was also about restoring order, removing threats from our streets, and ensuring the safety and well-being of Charleston area residents. I was wondering if you could respond to that. I mean, what was the actual effect on the safety and well-being of residents? You know, looking around the community the next morning after this raid, what was the actual impact?
The day after El Alamo nightclub was raided, all of the Hispanic businesses in the area were closing down. The setting stage for El Alamo raid was at the flea market, which is booming in the mornings, the weekends of Saturday and Sunday. It's full of people, vendors, people who are trying to buy things. Like, it's, you know, it's full of people. And that morning, it was empty. There was no one. They were all scared. The community was in fear of coming out of their houses and buying their groceries. And the impact that it has in our communities, the fear, the chaos, the uncertainty of what is next, who is being targeted next. Because at this moment, and this goes hand in hand with transparency, people don't know what is going on. They don't know the facts of things. And then when these facts are presented, they are not clear to the community and they don't sound real when they say, oh, we came to this nightclub with 116 outstanding warrants and we arrested 80 criminals who were cartel members, essentially. That's the way it was painted. The community this, well, first of all, the community does not trust this because they know that they go here to have a time of enjoyment during the weekend. But then for the officials to say this, now it places a bigger threat to the community to even enjoy themselves, to even exist. So we're no longer allowed to go to nightclubs. We're no longer allowed to go grocery shopping at the flea market. We're no longer allowed to go to a restaurant to eat. So our existence itself is being questioned. Like, we're not allowed to exist anymore. And then the morning after, like I mentioned, the businesses closed down. The restaurants were empty. Waiters were sent back home. The flea market was empty. Vendors didn't show up. It was completely isolated. And like, even like people who took videos who did show up was like, this is like crickets here. There's no one here.
Yeah, that was such an eerie detail for me the morning after, just because you and I both grew up here, that flea market, you know, it's more than just a flea market. People set up produce stands there. It's usually packed. It's a very busy place on the weekends, and to see it deserted like that was really a sign that something has gone very wrong. I want to get back to something you said about people not believing what they hear from law enforcement and the lack of transparency. So, you know, after the raid, I tried asking local sheriff's offices if they had incident reports. You know, normally, anytime the police are responding to a scene or make an arrest, they write up some paperwork. You know, this is like standard basic stuff for police, and they kept telling me they had nothing. Journalists have been following up ever since, trying to get answers. You know, the local police say, you need to talk to Homeland Security and ICE, and ICE is just stonewalling them. So there's a quote here I wanted you to respond to. This was the Post and Courier newspaper kept asking ICE for details about what happened, the names of the people they arrested. And there's a spokesperson in the ICE Public Affairs Office named Lindsay Williams, who said, "There's mountains of paperwork. You won't get it." What do you say to that? I mean, what message does that send to people?
It gives a message that there is no transparency, first of all. It gives a message that the people are not important to law enforcement, essentially. Because if they were, they would try to calm them down, give them a peace of mind of, this is what happened, this is how it was carried out. But to this day, we still don't even have a full list of those people who were detained or where they were taken. And in the aftermath of this, family members of the detained people were wondering where their family members went, where they were taken. And a lot of these people were in contact with us, like asking us, can you help us locate so-and-so? We have called, they haven't answered. We have looked at the ICE locator, they're not there. It was a lot of confusion. Again, like, even with, there's confusion with the arrest, there's confusion with how this enforcement is being carried out, there's confusion with where the people ended up.
The last thing I wanted to talk to you about is something that you may already be tired of talking about. I know you've been all over the state talking about this, but 287G agreements. Just to review for our listeners, ordinarily in the United States, immigration enforcement is the job of federal agencies, ICE, Homeland Security, Border Patrol. But there is a section of law known as 287G where ICE can train and authorize local law enforcement officers to do some enforcement work for them. And that can include identifying, arresting, and detaining people potentially for deportation. So there's a range of types of 287G agreements, but in the most expansive version, which is known as the task force model, local police can make immigration arrests during routine police enforcement. So at a traffic stop, at an arrest for something totally unrelated. And local police under these agreements are effectively turned into ICE agents. You know, your local sheriff, your local police officer could be executing ICE warrants or questioning people about their legal status. You've taken a look at these. You've seen their impact in real time. We've seen them expand quite a bit around the state. What are some of the problems that you see with these 287G agreements? What is their actual impact here?
So first of all, Paul, thank you so much for coming up with the Is Your Local Police Collaborating with ICE blog post, which you can find at the ACLU website, everyone.
Yep, that's aclusc.org/287G. I'll put it in the show notes.
And updating that weekly, because every week we see that more and more counties are joining this agreement. So at the beginning of the year, there were only three counties that had an ICE agreement, that had a 287G agreement. And now it is tenfold of what we saw at the beginning of the year. It's about 30 counties at this moment. I don't know.
30 agreements. And yeah, some of these are county level. Some of them are like local small town police departments. Some of them are statewide agencies. But yeah, you're right. Tenfold increase in this calendar year.
So we see that increase. And then adding on to that, we see the Department of Public Safety also wanting to join 287G agreement. So
right. And Department of Public Safety oversees Highway Patrol. That's a significant change, I think. But yeah, just generally, I mean, looking at these agreements, what are the problems you see? What harm do they cause in communities?
So 287G agreements place many harms in the community. First of all, public trust and public safety. So like we mentioned before, the people are already not trusting law enforcement. And we see this even prior to 287G. It was hard for the community to feel safe navigating complex systems of calling the police or, getting resources that they need. But when these resources are entangled with potential deportation or questioning of their status, I think that trust is completely eroded. Before working with the ACLU, I was working with a nonprofit law firm that assisted victims of domestic violence. And these victims, in order for them to get an immigration relief, they need to call law enforcement and get an incident report and collaborate with them and constantly, be in communication with them in order to get that immigration relief. Now, from what I'm hearing, a lot of victims are not reporting the crime because they're scared that if they call the police, their status will be questioned, that they will not be helped, and instead that they will be separated from their children. So this is just one example of how that trust is being eroded, but there are many more examples. But just, going with that, we also see that public safety is impacted. So 287G agreements do not really have a positive impact on public safety. And as we can tell from the Cato Institute and other forms of research, 287G agreements do not make communities more safe. When we have 287G agreements in place, people are scared to report crime. They are scared to call the police. And as a result, that makes our communities less safe. When a person witnesses a crime, but instead of calling 911 because they feel that they might be questioned about their status, that makes our communities less safe in general, not just the immigrant community, but all of our communities in general. And when we add on to how does this take away from local policing? So when an officer could be carrying out local policing, patrolling our streets, going to a call for an incident report, whatever else that police was supposed to do, and now he's carrying out federal enforcement, that also takes away from our public safety. When that police officer is no longer carrying out the duties that he signed up to do. So, and also, how much does this cost our communities? So Charleston County, which is back with an 287G agreement. They had gotten rid of their agreement under Kristen Graziano, but now are back under Carl Ritchie. They share that it costed $4 million per year to have these agreements in place. So that was just one county alone. How much is this taking from all 30 counties or 35 or 40, whenever we get to that point? How much money is it going to cost our state? how much is it going to cost our counties locally, and what is the impact that this is going to have in our communities? When these resources are being funneled to law enforcement, federal law enforcement, instead of helping our communities here locally.
Right. Yeah, one thing I try to stress to people is that these agreements used to be really rare. And part of the reason was that local police didn't want any part of it. You know, some of the most outspoken opponents of 287G were like sheriffs, police chiefs who said, you know, we have enough work to do. We don't want to be sidetracked doing this work for ICE. And something has really shifted this year. And it's not good news for public safety. I want to go now. We're going to shift time and place a little bit in this next segment. This is going to be a trip that you and I went on to Beaufort County back on July 8th. So at the time, the sheriff there, PJ Tanner, had announced that he wanted to enter a 287G agreement. And there was vocal, widespread pushback. Hundreds of people came out to these Q&A meetings or sort of town hall meetings to talk to the sheriff and share their concern. It's July 8th. Dulce and I are here at the Beaufort County Sheriff's Office, along with hundreds of locals who are here to ask questions and raise concerns about a potential 287G ICE partnership that the sheriff wants to enter. Now, to his credit, unlike most sheriffs in the state, Sheriff PJ Tanner is hosting a couple of public question and answer events where people can ask questions about the program. This is the first of those events, and people have filled this room to capacity and are spilling out the door into the lobby. Everyone we talked to on the way in opposes collaboration with ICE. Now, it remains to be seen whether the sheriff will listen to their concerns. Here's Sheriff Tanner now.
Have anyone in here, part of my giving information, I'm going to ask a few questions too. Has anyone in here Googled 287G program?
Yes.
Okay, so you do have some fundamental knowledge.
Yes.
Has anyone in here watched any national media about the 287G program?
Yes.
And based on all of the knowledge that you have gathered and had the opportunity to gather, hopefully you formulated a question that actually pertains to Beaufort County, South Carolina. If you've got questions about what they're doing in New York or LA, or Wisconsin, or New Jersey, or Connecticut, or North Carolina, or Savannah, Georgia, I don't have information for you on that because I have nothing to do with those states or those counties, those areas, okay? So the 287G program, just to take you back in time, 2008, George Bush Jr. was President of the United States. In 2008, there were 18 task force that were allowed in the United States. And we were one of those task force. We were a task force operator from 2008 till 2012. I had five deputy sheriffs that were trained as immigration agents. Do y'all remember that?
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's pause the tape here and note one thing. It is true that Beaufort County previously entered a 287G task force agreement and that it ended in 2012. What Sheriff Tanner failed to mention here is the reason why it ended in 2012. The task force model is the most expansive form of ICE collaboration. It effectively turns some number of local law enforcement officers into ICE agents. In 2012, ICE itself shut down all task force agreements across the country due to a pattern of rampant racial profiling and abuses by local police across the country. The program enabled and encouraged civil rights violations, most infamously in Maricopa County, Arizona, where Sheriff Joe Arpaio boasted about running what he called a concentration camp under tents in the desert. So these task force model agreements were off the table entirely from 2012 until 2025, when the second Trump administration started the program back up. important context to note because the sheriff here is applying to re-enter that program. And I'll note that the fine print on the Beaufort County agreement says that Beaufort County deputies would be authorized, and I quote, to interrogate any alien or person believed to be an alien as to his right to remain in the United States, end quote. Okay, here's Sheriff Tanner again.
The benefits of 287G in 2008 and 2012 are actually better today than they were then. Why? Is because of the intel section that we would have access to. You cannot have access to their intelligence unless you are part of the program. If you are part of the program, then you get, not only do we get the intel from the FBI, called NCIC, but we also get the intel from the IDENT system, which is a part of Homeland Security. If we get information and intelligence from the IDENT system, it also is in getting intelligence from what they call the Eagle system. The Eagle system for us, if we're investigating a crime, and we don't care who, you know, when I say that, we don't know who the offender is, we don't know anything about the offender, but once we start identifying who that offender is, it's our job to find out everything about them, regardless of who they are. So having the ability to have that computer system at our office to query information about those that we suspect are a person of interest in committing a crime gives us the opportunity to make an arrest based on knowledge, based on fact, based on probable cause.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about the people who might show up in this ICE database that Sheriff Tanner is talking about. Contrary to what you'll hear from people like White House advisor Stephen Miller, ICE is not going after the quote-unquote worst of the worst. In fact, according to ICE's own publicly available data, as officers sought to meet the arbitrary deportation quotas set by Stephen Miller, most people detained by ICE this year have had no criminal record whatsoever. The most recent data as of this recording show that 72% of immigration detainees had no criminal convictions on their record. So, maybe a good follow-up question here is, what good is that ICE database, really? Who are you trying to catch? But I digress. Here's one of the questions from the Q&A session. The person speaking here is Amy Deverell, a local immigration lawyer.
I want to thank the council first for calling the meeting, because there has been a complete lack of information about what's being requested and how much it's going to cost. And that we really needed that information, so thank you, all of you, for calling this very important meeting. My name is Amy Deverell. I'm an immigration lawyer, and I'm bringing my own client's question from the heart of Beaufort County.
Okay.
This is not from another county or another state.
Okay.
She sent me an email on Sunday, July 6th. It says, yesterday afternoon, we realized that someone had shot our car here at our home. It had to happen in the middle of the night. We're pretty scared because the car is parked right next to the bedroom where my daughters sleep. We don't have problems with anyone. There were two bullets inside the car that didn't come out. But we are afraid to call the police because of everything that is happening with immigrants. What do you recommend that we do? Normally that would have been an easy question for me to answer, Sheriff, and I'm embarrassed that it was not an easy question for me right now. The buck stops here. You did that. When you apply for this contract and you start talking about getting immigration involved in what you're doing, we all agree that the bad guys need to be taken care of. I'm a mom. I don't want people driving around drunk. I don't want people shooting next to where people's kids are sleeping. We want the bad guys taken care of. But what this program does is it affects the victims. Then you have victims that are scared to come forward because they don't know what's going to happen to them. We can't guarantee what's going to happen to them when 287G is involved. And when people don't report, the bad guys go free and we're all left safe. So you didn't have to apply for this, and I am begging you again, as I begged you in 2017, to please withdraw the application. We don't need it. ICE just got 350% budget increase last week. They have plenty of help. They don't need your help.
The sheriff didn't have an answer for that one. I'll note here that this Q&A session was sort of bizarre. It wasn't exactly a town hall. People rose to speak at a lectern, And a lot of the time, Sheriff Tanner stood directly on the other side of the podium, staring at them. Some people felt a little intimidated by that. Other times, the sheriff just started pacing and lecturing people. He did not strike me as the kind of leader who is used to people asking a lot of questions. Up next is Will McCorkle, an organizer with the Charleston Immigrant Coalition.
This is a similar rhetoric we're seeing across counties in South Carolina. When the sheriff's office tries to bring forth these agreements, it's always focusing on we're going to stop immigrant criminals. I don't think anyone's actually against stopping someone who's committed a felony, who's dangerous. But what happens in county after county, it's like a playbook that's happening. They give this rhetoric, they say this, and then when it's actually passed, they're picking up people for not having a driver's license. And I think the point that you made is saying we don't deport people in Beaufort County. Of course, Beaufort County doesn't directly deport individuals. No one believes that. But you're putting individuals in immigration detention who are going to be treated under this administration in ways that defy basic human rights. And we're seeing people, we're seeing innocent individuals being sent to a death camp in El Salvador. We're seeing people being sent to South Sudan.
From Beaufort County, South Carolina.
Well, it could happen. Yes, if you detain someone in Beaufort County, they can be sent to the detention center. So you cannot separate what happens when you pick someone up for not having a license and where they're actually going to end up. And so it is a national issue. It's not.
Is everyone required to have a driver's license to drive on the highways and byways?
It doesn't mean they should be sent to El Salvador to a death camp. And you're opening that door right now by working with an administration, an ICE administration.
That's a political comment. Next question.
You're
talking about an administration that I have no control over.
In case you didn't catch that last part, Sheriff Tanner said, "You're talking about an administration that I have no control over." This type of rhetorical dodge was a recurring theme of the night. Sheriff Tanner said at various times during the evening that he had no control over the county jail, even though he does send people there. The sheriff said he had no control over what ICE does, even though he was inviting them to his own community. And in response to Will's question, the sheriff said he had no control over where detainees would be sent, which is true, but he is here volunteering to send his neighbors into the maw of that system. Here's another interesting exchange with a local.
I would think it would be the exact opposite. I mean, I've heard all these comments about the current administration, and if there's a sheriff in South Carolina that doesn't want to participate with what he's trying to accomplish, wouldn't you think that would be the worst end of it?
No.
Okay. All right.
I'm really not sure what to make of that. I'll wrap this up with the public comment that my colleague Dulce gave. Here's what she had to say.
But hopefully I can give you some more information. Yes, ma'am.
Hello, Sheriff Tanner. My name is Dulce Lopez. I'm here today with the ACLU of South Carolina. I'm here as a concerned citizen, and I'm here as a person who works with people in Beaufort County, victims of human trafficking and victims of crime. And my question to you is, you're considering entering this program, which is the Task Force Model Agreement, which is the most aggressive format of the 287G agreements. And it has a deeply troubling history. We can see it, and you said not to talk about other states, but I can only share about nationally, we see a pattern of racial profiling. We see a pattern of complete disregard for the Fourth Amendment. We see a pattern of violations to people and their rights. We see a pattern of people of color being identified as criminals just because they are a little darker than
other
people.
That's not Beaufort.
This is Beaufort, and I will say I work here throughout the year. I come to Beaufort, and I work with non-workers. I work with rural people in the community. And what is it that we're seeing? They're afraid of this agreement, the 287G agreement. So why are you opening the door to the very same abuses that we're seeing nationally? Why are you opening the door to racial profiling?
Right. having said that in further detail, and my lawyer can explain it to you in more detail, but if the federal government comes into Beaufort County to enforce federal law, there is nothing I can do to stop them. And I will not get in their way because they will put me in jail.
The supremacy clause
is very clear. But let me offer this to you. If the federal government can come to Beaufort County and enforce the law like they have done over the years, if they can do that anytime they feel like they need to, wouldn't it be better that I have some relationship with them, my information, my input, and give guidance on what I think is best for Beaufort County? Or do I just leave the door closed, turn a blind eye to everything, and when the federal government shows up and y'all start having issues with it, then you're going to want me to do something? There are people in this country that believe that sheriffs have the authority that when ATF was thinking about taking your gun, yet the sheriffs had the authority to stop ATF agents from coming to your house and taking your guns. That is absolutely, that's misinformation, and that kind of stuff is dangerous in the community. I would rather be a neutral person in that front if immigration shows up, just like the FBI or anyone else. You would rather have me in a position to negotiate other than just turn the other.
So will you be neutral?
Nope.
So what else are you
playing? Sir, respectfully, you are in a position of authority, and you are the one deciding to enter this agreement. So we ask you that you put your community first, that you put your farm workers, your Hispanic community, your people of color first before you enter into this agreement. Thank you.
On July 31st, 2025, despite multiple public meetings and protests where hundreds of Beaufort County residents expressed their outrage at a proposed collaboration agreement with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Sheriff P.J. Tanner signed a 287G Task Force Agreement, the most aggressive form of collaboration. For the final segment of today's podcast, I'm joined by two Beaufort County residents who have been speaking out against the 287G agreement in the weeks since the sheriff signed it. And Blaine, thanks so much for joining me. I was wondering if you could start by just introducing yourselves and telling me a little bit about your life in Beaufort County.
Okay. I'm Ann Dickerson. I've lived in Beaufort County for about 10 years. Before I moved here, I really had never thought about it, but I came down with my son. He wanted to find a place. And the minute I drove into town, I said, this is where I want to live. And 2 years later, I moved. So I've been really happy. I think this is an amazing community of all kinds of people from lots of places and a real sense of history. I've always been a buff of Southern history, so I like that about this place.
It is an incredible place. Beautiful, rooted in history, but yes. Always changing.
Yes.
And Blaine, how about you?
Okay, I'm Blaine Lotz, and my wife Lynn and I have lived on Hilton Head Island for 20 years full time, and before that we'd been property owners and second homeowners here for many years, going back to the 70s, in fact. But I was a career Air Force officer. I served 26 years on active duty, and then I was a career civilian in the Defense Department, and we retired in 2005, and that's when we moved here. And we absolutely love Beaufort County and love Hilton Head Island. We've been involved in so many of the activities and have been so impressed with the Gullah heritage and so much else that the area has to offer and for us to learn about.
Well, we're here to talk about immigration enforcement and the 287G agreement that was signed in Beaufort County. And I wanted to talk to you both because I know you've followed it closely. You've stayed engaged even after the agreement was signed. But backing up a little bit, how did you first learn about the proposed 287G agreement? And what were some of the concerns that you had about it?
I think I first heard about it. I'm not really sure how I first became aware it was going to be an issue here. Although I remember in Trump's first term, we protested the same issue, but it wasn't quite as rampant then as it certainly has been lately. But I really became aware of it when, ironically, when Sheriff Tanner set up his meetings to speak to the community about it, because that brought it front and center, and followed very closely how people reacted to those meetings, which was with utter disgust, anger, everything else under the sun on the negative side. So that was my first, how I first got involved heavily with this issue. And of course, worrying about, I just recently renovated my house, and virtually everybody who worked on it was, spoke Spanish, and worrying about what was going to happen to so many of the workers here, neighbors, friends.
I've been a participant in the in our local Immigration Coalition Council, and it was there that I first learned about the 287G aspects of the Immigration Act, the larger Immigration Act. And we, one of the things we developed here on the island was a rally and a march protesting Sheriff Tanner's involvement with ICE and link up with ICE on, under 287G. We started with a rally at the Veterans Memorial on Shelter Cove Lane, and we marched about a block toward the sheriff's office here on Hilton Head Island. And I had been asked to give an opening talk as well as offer a prayer at the rally that we had. And we had probably 50, 75 people participating, and then marched past the sheriff's office. Of course, he wasn't there, but it was symbolic, and it was to express our disappointment and chagrin at involving ICE in our community. Masked individuals rounding up people without due process. Everything about that has appeared to me to be so wrong.
Blaine, I've heard from a lot of people this year who attended their first protest or rally in their life. Looking at the people who came out to that protest, were there a lot of first timers, or were these people who had been to a few protests before?
Well, there were a lot of first timers, because a lot of people had never done that before. And in the weekly protests that we coordinate, those have been a lot of first timers. And I've had so many people who say, I don't know if I'm doing good, but it is making me feel better, because the alternative is sitting in front of the television and hearing terrible news about terrible things being done to our neighbors. And people who don't want to do that and want to see what they can contribute. So that those first timers are an integral part of what we're trying to do here on Hilton Head Island. And I'm so grateful for them. And the gamut runs through so many folks, older, some retired military, African Americans, younger people and students, tourists. We've had, I'll give you one example. We've had a young man who came one day and he introduced himself to me, and he said, you know, my family, we're visiting here for the week. My family's at the beach, but I came by and saw you demonstrating, and I wanted to be part of it. And that's, to me, that's a wonderful response to how we can try to convince people that this is so wrong.
I think there's something to that, going out and actually doing something instead of just watching events unfold on TV. These protests, they're weekly now. Is that still an ongoing weekly protest? And tell me a little bit more about how that goes. You know, where you protest and what happens with those?
Okay, yeah, we've been doing this now on a weekly basis. We do it at the same location every week. We do it at the same time every week from noon to one, but we vary the day. And the reason we do that is so that we can include people who, well, maybe they have a job or a commitment or a meeting on a certain day. And so we vary that date of the day of the week. Now, one of the things that that we've been able to see as a result is that Saturday appears to be the best day because we have a number of people who come by. Some are locals who are running errands, but many people are tourists who are either checking in to their timeshares on a Saturday, or they're people who are departing. So we get the comings and the goings of a large number of folks, and that seems to be good. We have much greater positive response today than we have negative response. Lots of horn honks, lots of thumbs ups, and waves, and good words. But it's heartening to see that, and to see folks who have such a positive response to what we're doing. And by the way, our signage that we have, particularly that, and it doesn't all involve the immigration issue, but we have signs such as support our neighbors, be kind, protect our families, justice first, melt ice, and no ice on Hilton Head Island. So we have a couple of negatives there, but you get the message. And we're trying to be positive. These are our neighbors. These are our friends. And we have a responsibility to look out for them.
My kids will cringe when they hear me say this, but it sounds like there's been a vibe shift that, you know, you're being a little bit better received when you go out and say these things. And yeah, the actions of ICE are broadly unpopular, and you wouldn't always know it from watching the news in this country, but masked agents taking people off the streets, putting them in unmarked cars, disappearing them, is not something that most Americans can countenance. It's really viscerally upsetting. And I'm glad that you're staying there, bearing witness the way you do. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what you've learned about organizing and protesting and petitioning with your neighbors. As Blaine mentioned earlier, this is a community with a lot of military families, military retirees, Gullah Geechee communities, immigrant communities. It's a pretty diverse population and people from all over the political spectrum. What are some things you've learned just, you know, talking to people from all these different backgrounds?
Well, we have been holding weekly protests ever since the beginning of February also. And they've been advertised. I think one of the main things is we have quite a few people who lead various communities in this town who are, we're all amplifying the message around these protests, which are the same time, the same day, same place every week, just so that people don't get confused about or have to keep checking where to go. But we have, friends such as the Low Country Pride and the Families Against Book Bans and the League of Women Voters, as well as Indivisible and the Dems, who are putting the word out there. And when you have all these different various organizations reaching out, you do reach people. We have Republicans who come out as well as people who voted Democrat their whole life. We've noticed that, speaking for Indivisible in particular, that our membership and our active participants were mostly female and older. But now that people see the protests on the street and with a lot of the issues that hit the military families, we're getting a lot more men coming out, a lot more people, younger people. We've had a lot of young teachers who have come out to join the effort because of the assaults on education. And you know, at times it's a very, the diversity calls for some, well, I should say it raises some issues because it's some, I moderate the Indivisible Facebook page and we get all kinds of suggestions about do this and not that. And then if somebody else chimes in and no, you know, with the opposite point of view, but we found that if we just hold a steady course and determine what, we think is sort of a middle road among all the activists, that we can continue to get people who come out to support us who are not always on the same page about every issue. And that certainly helps. And I have found that immigration is one of the most unifying issues that we found. I mean, we have some people who are very pro-abortion and we have some people who are very anti-abortion, and they come out and they have very civic, you know, civilized discussions with each other about all kinds of issues and agree to disagree on what they don't agree on. And that's been gratifying.
Well, and my hat is off to you moderating a Facebook page. I know that can be overwhelming. It's
980 members, so it is overwhelming. But
yeah, you see people really going at each other sometimes on social media, but in person, it's a little harder to blow up on somebody and yell. It's,
yes,
you're forced to actually talk to somebody. That's I think that's still worth doing. Well, the sheriff in Beaufort County, Sheriff Tanner, didn't listen after the Q&A meetings and after people voiced their concerns, and he went ahead and signed a 287G agreement in August of this year. And not only that, but he opted for the most extreme form of collaboration, the task force model. I always try to remind people of the context. You know, this is of the three types of ICE agreements on the table, this is the most extreme form of collaboration. It allows local law enforcement officers to essentially serve as agents of ICE. I know it's only been a little over a month as we're recording this, but have you seen any difference in the way law enforcement is carried out, or is it sort of too soon to tell right now?
I think it's too soon to tell. Up here, we have people who have been downloading the, I think it's Block ICE or the app you can get for your iPhone that will tell you if there's a sighting, and we haven't had any activity on that app yet. But I think we have a lot of people who are ready and willing if there is some active interventions or grabbing of immigrants here, who are willing to go out there and put their bodies on the line. So we're ready and willing. We just haven't seen much activity yet. I read that in the newspaper article that Sheriff Tanner is pulling back in, I believe, some retired officers and training them specifically to work with ICE. So it's possible he hasn't gotten his efforts ramped up yet.
Well, I saw that you were able to follow up with the sheriff with a petition that and you and Indivisible circulated. You got more than 600 signatures on this petition calling on Sheriff Tanner to refuse to cooperate with ICE. And you delivered that petition on September 15th. Tell me a little bit about delivering it that day. I mean, did you get to actually see the sheriff face to face and deliver that? Or what was that interaction like?
Well, he was at the office. He would not come down. We delivered it to one of his deputies, who listened to our little spiel, and reading his body language was not taking anything in. But then as we were leaving, Sheriff Tanner did come down and give us a big smile and a wave and said, thank you all for coming. And several people tried to ask him a question, but of course he just kept smiling and waving and saying, thank you all for coming. So in that sense, it was a strange kind of ending to this story. But I think the main thing people took away from it was that they didn't want the sheriff to have the last word after the meeting he did here in Beaufort. They came away feeling that he wouldn't listen or give them the time of day or give them any respect. And so they wanted to have their voice and deliver their message to him again.
Well, Anne Blaine, I just want to thank both of you for staying active, raising your voices, even after a disappointing outcome like the sheriff signing this agreement. I say this all the time, but it's easy to feel despair when you watch national news and it seems like it's just happening to us. But the local level is still where people have power. You know, sheriffs are elected. County councils control their budgets. There are still democratic levers to push here, and I'm really grateful for both of you staying, organizing your neighbors, and speaking out the way you do. So, thank you both. Thanks for what you do, and thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
On September 25th, law enforcement vehicles swarmed to a landscaping and nursery business in Bluffton as agents of ICE, the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, and the Beaufort County Sheriff's Office participated in a raid. Authorities say they arrested 5 people on charges of using false social security numbers to obtain employment. Witnesses described a chaotic scene. One landscaper who was there at the time, a U.S. citizen born in Beaufort, told local news station WJCL that one agent kicked him in the legs, grabbed his head, hit him, and detained him. The man who asked to remain anonymous told WJCL, quote, "People are scared, especially women. They're only targeting us because of our color. The ones who looked American, they didn't even ask them if they were legal or not." End quote. We've submitted a Freedom of Information request to the Beaufort County Sheriff's Office for more information.
Thank you for listening to episode 16 of While I Breathe.
Jace, one thing you did as our director this year was push us to get more involved in immigrant rights. And that was not something that we had prioritized in the last year as the ACLU of South Carolina. But this year, early on, you kind of saw what was happening. You recognized what this incoming administration was about to do and made some decisions that included, for example, hiring Dulce. I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about that decision, you know, what you saw coming down the line and why you felt it was important for us to prioritize this.
I make a lot of decisions for the ACLU of South Carolina that are really, really difficult. And I'll be honest, this was not a difficult one. You know, when Trump was running for office, he made it clear that he had a mass deportation campaign all worked out in his head. And I knew that, you know, while a lot of immigration policy, you know, is handled at the federal level, it's what Congress decides. I knew that his attacks on immigrants would be coming to our communities. And so I reached out to immigrant community leaders and I asked them if they believed that there was an important role for the ACLU of South Carolina to play. And they unanimously told me yes. And I'm so grateful to those folks who took time out of their day to talk to me about the immigrant rights landscape in South Carolina and what they believed the needs were and the opportunities. And after talking with them, I felt sure that we needed to create more of a focus and put more capacity around responding to increased immigration enforcement. And we're lucky to have Dulce with us to do that, to train folks on what their rights are, to connect immigrant community leaders in different communities, to set up rapid response networks. So much of this work right now is unfortunately not about stopping increased immigration enforcement. It is about protecting our communities as best we can from, you know, a masked force of immigration agents who seem all too willing to trample on our civil rights and civil liberties.
I wanted to follow up on a few calls to action and things that I mentioned at the end of last episode. One, we have a petition going against an ICE detention camp. There is a proposal that's been floated by several people running for governor next year. They all want to replicate Florida's now infamous Alligator Alcatraz facility in our state. So there is a petition at aclusc.org/ICE25 that has 13,000 signatures and counting, nearly all from South Carolina. People really don't want this. They see what's been happening in Florida. So if you haven't already, go check that out. Again, it's at aclusc.org/ICE25. You can add your signature there and share it around. There's also an update I wanted to give on something that I mentioned. There's a movement to create ICE verification hotlines around the country, and it's taken a lot of different forms, but here in South Carolina, as far as we can tell, the first sort of organized ICE verification hotline has started in the Charleston area. And what this is when people see something happening and think, well, that looks like ICE, but I'm not sure because they have an unmarked van or it's not really clear what's going on, they can call it in, they can send in a report, and then volunteers are dispatched to the scene to go ask questions, record video, not to interfere, but to document and to try and verify what's really going on so that we can spread the news. So that is now live. You can find more information on Instagram at @CHS_hotline. That's @CHS_hotline. If you see something in the Charleston area, you can also call that hotline at 843-806-0414. And finally, if you or someone you know have experienced an immigration raid or witnessed an immigration raid in South Carolina, we want to hear your story. So hearing community members' stories helps us understand how people's rights are being violated as part of immigration enforcement efforts. We have a form that you can fill out and that you can share with friends and neighbors. It has bilingual instructions in Spanish and English. That is available on our website at aclusc.org/redada. So that is REDADA. So that's aclusc.org/redada.
Thank you for listening, everyone. And until next time, while I breathe, I hope.